Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, and you're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. And I am absolutely so thrilled today. We have two of the absolute smartest wine writers in the country, and I cannot wait to introduce you to these guys. First, we have Ted Luce, a former editor of Wine Spectator. He's written about wine for Bon Appetit, Decanter, Town & Country, and many other publications. He currently has a column on Epicurious called Tasting Notes, and you can follow him on Twitter at Loose Lips, and he also contributes to New York Times and Architectural Digest and Vogue about many other topics, not just wine, but just a slew of topics. So
I'm guilty of being involved with the lamestream media. And thank you for having me, sir.
Excited. And then we also have Talia Baiocchi, the wine editor for Eater.com, as well as a wine editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, contributor to Decanter and many other publications. Talia is one of the young bucks in the wine industry, and certainly someone who is changing the world in the way we look at wine. It's true. It's true.
Happy to be here.
One of the things that Talia covers is restaurant wine lists, and I've never seen anyone who really just focuses on looking at wine lists and reviewing wine lists, much the way that someone might review a restaurant. So what I do want to start with, especially since restaurants are a topic that...
We're at one.
We're at one here.
A very good one.
What are some of both of your favorite restaurant wine lists here in New York, and what do you like about them?
Take it away, Ted.
Well, you know, I'm also, restaurant wine lists are such a great topic because it's all about the personal vision of the sommelier and the people that do the wine direction, and it can go so wrong too. Mm-hmm. You find people that like get wine lists that are sort of, you know, based on whoever just came that day to sell them wine. And I think that there's great places. The folks at Cook Shop and Five Points and their new place, 100 Acres, I like their list. It's very, you know, it's diverse, but you also feel like there's some kind of actual personal interest behind it. One of the tips I gave in an Epicurious column was always look for the outliers on a list. If you see a list with, you know...
The unpronounceables.
Yeah, if you see all Bordeaux and Burgundy and then you see one Finger Lakes, it's probably because that Finger Lakes Riesling is like a killer wine, mm-hmm. that the wine director, the sommelier, loves. So I kind of look for the doesn't fit wine on every list. And I think, you know, there's a lot of those out there.
I think the exciting thing right now is that I think that we're allowing, not necessarily the consumer is allowing, but I think we're seeing the industry change to where the wine list becomes really a reflection of the culture of the restaurant in a really exciting way. And I think that before, I mean, now the wine world is so big and there's so many wines. And I think you're seeing a real vision from the person putting it together, not only a reflection of what the chef is doing in the kitchen, but that person's ideology. And I think you're seeing that at a place like Reynard in Williamsburg, Lee Campbell, who's put together this terrific sort of esoteric, and she's been, you know, kind of criticized because the list is esoteric.
I'm going tonight for dinner, actually, to Reynard, so I'll check
it out.
Yeah.
It's great. And it's all these really small French producers that you wouldn't necessarily see on your average wine list. So I love Reynard. I love Vinegar Hill House because I think, again, like that wine list could not be anywhere else. Franny's for, you know, having this, you know, a lot of sort of Italy's kind of outside off the beaten path wines. And I think you've done the same thing at Dell'Anima. I mean, this is sort of just like a love letter to all of the kind of unloved wines that were unloved for a long time in Italy.
You know, it's something that we struggle with a bit at the wine bar, at our wine bar Anfora, where my true love is all those unpronounceables, as you said, those outliers. I think to a certain extent, I've maybe created a whole list of outsiders. And sometimes I feel like I've gotten a bit of criticism for it not being as approachable. And I just wonder from you guys, do you feel like, do you like to see a list that has some just easy to recognize? Do you think that's important for consumers? Or would you prefer something that is truly what the wine buyer is passionate about?
Well, we're wine geeks, so of course we look for something, you know, we want to be like, thrill us, give us something we've never seen. I think people do like to see a few familiar names, but I always say, why would you want the same selection as in your wine shop? Like, you're going to dinner, hopefully the chef is giving you something you can't get at home, and hopefully the wine director is giving you something you can't get on the corner. So I think throwing in a few familiar names maybe makes people feel like they're kind of grounded, but, you know, surprise people.
Yeah, I think that it all comes down, to wine service and who's on the floor and who's, like, really trying to help people kind of navigate a wine list that's really esoteric. I think a wine list can be totally out there, but you have to have someone there to say, hey, like, you know, this is what, you know, these wines from the Jura are like, and this is what orange wine is like. So they know what to expect. So someone's not blindly going in there and saying, I don't recognize anything. What do I do?
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And yeah, we do try to also have those. There's a Pinot Noir by the glass, so that someone can order Pinot Noir. It's still going to be in what we respect and think about with Pinot Noir, but it's going to be something easy.
It's probably going to be like Pinot Noir from the Jura.
Yeah, or the Thurman region in Austria.
I just got back from Languedoc in southern France, sort of the other Provence, and that's, you know, such a great area for value wines, and, you know, people haven't totally discovered it yet, and hence there's just all these great, you know, some of them are varietally designated to give people that comfort, and others are, you know, named by the place in the European style, and I think there's a lot of stuff going on down there.
I agree. Absolutely. You know, I think that Languedoc has a lot of great vineyards that are undervalued because it's such a bad name for such a long time. So you find these startup winemakers, I think, much like Bushwick here in Brooklyn, people who can't necessarily afford a Fifth Avenue address or don't want to pay for it. And they're finding just some really interesting terroirs, and they're able to create some fascinating wines because of the land being undervalued out there.
Yeah, yeah. Bushwick is very similar to the Languedoc. Yeah.
Yes, but anyways, right?
We don't have Corbière and Faugère and some of these great things, but someone will plant grapes here soon. Yeah. They're doing everything else in Brooklyn. They're going to plant grapes somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't doubt it. We have a whole garden upstairs growing their honey and herbs. Grapes are next. Talia, where have you been recently that you find is just an under-the-radar, great-value wine region?
You know, it's funny because, I've spent a lot of time this past year in America, and I think people forget because we're always kind of looking to Europe, and I'm guilty of that. I think we're all guilty of that. But I've been spending a lot more time kind of discovering these little gems in even places like Napa, which is not a place that you think you're going to discover something new because it's a very, you know, sort of developed place. Willamette Valley, Oregon, I think that Pinot Noir is getting better and better there. And I think that's a product of some tough vintages, but some vintages that I think sort of speak to a leaner style of wine. Same is true for the far Sonoma coast. I think there's really great Pinot Noir coming out of there. And even, you know, you look at guys like Dan Petroski from Massican and Enrico Bertos from Arbe Garbe, and these guys are, you know, making Malvasia and Ribola and in the Russian River Valley and Napa, and these wines are, you know, $25 a bottle. I think that we need to forget, we forget sometimes to kind of pay attention to our own country. And
are you running for office in November? That sounds like part of your platform. Yeah, right. American wine.
Well, I mean, it's the only thing that I'm really patriotic about, to be honest with you.
I just got back from Walla Walla, and I think Washington Wine Country, which is now expanded way beyond Walla Walla. Essentially, like, most of the eastern part of Washington is like a wine region, it seems, based on just getting back. It's kind of amazing. I think they should also be put, you know, there's a lot of new appellations, new AVAs are coming online, and Washington is also really exciting right now.
Yeah, and as a lead-in, obviously, to the next segment, I think that Sherry and Sanlúcar de Barrameda and Jerez, you know, and even Monte Amarillis, like these wines are incredible. They're finally making a splash here. And I think it's way overdue. It's the first wine ever imported to the New World. And now we're finally figuring it out. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you guys about how exciting domestic wines are. And on our new list mm-hmm. at La Picho, we're going to have about a third domestic wines. So I think there's some really interesting things. However, I did want to ask you more about Walla Walla, because mm-hmm. that is not an area that I'm particularly familiar with. Are you finding, did you see in your recent trip that you have producers who are doing things similar to what you see in the Sonoma Coast or Santa Barbara, where people are making more balanced handmade wines, or are people still going for a certain amount of extraction up there?
Well, I think definitely, you know, there it's warmer there, so you're going to get bigger wines to some extent. But I was surprised by a lot of things. First of all, a lot of Walla Walla wine country is actually in Oregon, across the border, which you don't really realize till you get there, and you just find you're driving into Oregon to find, you know, a vineyard that's vinified across the line in Washington. Mm. But you know, they're really known for their reds, but I liked a lot of whites too. I think they actually.
I totally agree.
I think that it really surprised me, because I sort of thought of it as just, okay, it's Syrah, it's Cab, it's Merlot, and those wines are the most distributed. But I had some really great Viognier, I had some great Chardonnay. There's a lot going on there, and I think it's Oregon maybe has gotten more attention because Willamette is a small, contained, fantastic high-end area that essentially doesn't really produce any big value wines anymore. But Washington is like an open field, and it's just more wines are coming online all the time. It's kind of like Sonoma, Napa. Napa is one valley small, and Sonoma is five major valleys and, you know, all over the place. Mm-hmm. That's how you have to think of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I wanted to bring the line of questioning back to the restaurant industry. Ted, you've written in the past about your feelings on corkage in restaurants. I know as a wine professional, I love bringing bottles of wine. If I have a special bottle of wine to a restaurant, what are some of your guidelines and pet peeves when it comes to bringing wine to restaurants?
Well, I always find it fascinating. I know Talia will weigh in on this. When you get this kind of like shocked reaction, either on the phone or when you bring in your bottle, as if it was this crazy thing that you were proposing to bring your own wine. But some places, and the guys at Cook Shop, to cite them again, are really great. You know, it's a $20 corkage. They're just saying we want to make up for the markup that we're not getting. And that's it. After that, what, you know, why would they care if you want to enjoy something on your own? So I feel like it's kind of the diner's bill of rights that we should have that chance. Mm-hmm. But restaurants feel differently. Sometimes they say, we spent all this time putting together a wine list. Why would we put this service glitch in there? What do you think, Talia?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually having a conversation. I think we all have a conversation. We talk about this a lot. But, you know, a place like Brooklyn Fair, for example, which used to be BYO, and, you know, now I think their corkage fee is something like $75. And, you know, I understand that basically it's there so that you don't bring your own wine, because who's crazy right. enough to bring their own wine if it's $75 corkage fee, unless it's like DRC or something. You know, I mean, it's a tough subject. I think, you know, there's certain places, like there's a lot of really inexpensive places that'll have a $35, $40 corkage fee. And I think that's kind of wrong at the top end at like a, you know, if you're talking about a 3-4-star restaurant. You know, I mean, I get it. Like, their markup is much bigger. They're really trying to make that money. Their margins depend on wine, you know, the sale of wine. So I kind of get it. I guess I'm sort of, it's a cop out because I'm kind of a centrist on this. And I think it's a case by case kind of thing. I wish that inexpensive restaurants didn't charge as much for corkage, frankly.
One restaurateur said to me, if it's a white Zin, it's really annoying, because why are you doing that to us when we have a wine list? But, you know, if you bring in something, generally you get a reaction.
They should, like, screen people. Like,
exactly.
Oh, this bottle's $50 corkage.
You get a reaction from them. If you bring in something interesting and classy, you'll see the demeanor change from the wine staff or the waiter sometimes, if they can tell it's something like, you know what you're doing. But, mm-hmm. you know, if it's a really cheapo bottle of wine, you get this reaction that's like, don't waste our time.
Yeah.
What do you think, Joe? I mean, is it annoying when people come in with that?
You know, I actually do find it a little bit annoying if someone brings in a really cheapo bottle of wine.
Right.
That along with the corkage fee, we would give you something so much better than you're drinking. Yeah. You know, we have what I think is a reasonable corkage fee. It's $25 at our restaurants. Everyone knows that we're happy to. It's an unlimited. Some restaurants, you can only bring in two bottles. Mm-hmm. At our restaurants, it's completely unlimited. And I think you linked to, Ted, you linked to a website that, I don't know if you put it together or if you linked to it, and it listed all the restaurants in New York and their corkage, the corkage fee, and then how good their stemware is also.
Really funny. Great. That's a whole show, probably.
Yeah.
So we have great stemware. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you're washing and polishing stemware, those glasses break, and we have these like beautiful handmade, you know, crystal glasses.
Cool. What's your who is your producer of your stemware?
Luigi Bormioli from Milan, and they're really beautiful. And it's just, you know, if a glass broke and you didn't charge a corkage, that would be terrible. But I also really love bringing wine. Last night I went to Hakata Tonton with my girlfriend, great place, and brought a bottle of sake. And you can bring sake to restaurants as well, and this will charge you.
Good point.
But just to play devil's advocate,
please.
You said it's part of the diner's bill of rights to be able to bring a bottle of wine, and I agree with you. I want to be able to bring wine.
Right.
Why would a diner not be able to, you know, bring a steak or
bring their own rice? Which actually I've witnessed that.
Right. Well, obviously, you're not going to.
You make a point, but I think the thing that has always been said to me is, oh, we have to. Food costs are so high, we can't really make any money on food, so every restaurant pretty much makes money on the booze, which is fine. But I say, why does wine have to take the hit for food? I just don't think it's two separate things. I think, you know, wine is important enough to get its own consideration and shouldn't have to sort of pay for the entire restaurant experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
See, it's such a hard thing to, it's a tough subject.
I think the one thing that people don't realize, though, is that because of the health department restrictions, you actually, you know, you need to, yeah, it was kind of a trick question. I apologize for that. <It's all right. laughs> you can't bring food into, you know, into the kitchen. But wine, there's no legal problems with opening up a bottle of wine for
there
someone.
There should be a legal problem with like bringing a box of Uncle Ben's. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. Literally, a guy brought Uncle Ben's rice to a restaurant and asked it to be cooked, and then asked all of his food to have no salt. I was like, why are you even here?
Why are you in a restaurant?
Just cook the Uncle Ben's at home. It's cheaper.
That's the guy. There's one guy like that in every restaurant, probably.
Yeah. They're out there.
All right. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back with Talia Baiocchi and Ted Luce on In the Drink here at Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
And we're back with In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org, here with Talia Baiocchi and Ted Luce. two of the absolute smartest wine writers in the country right now. You can also follow them on Twitter at Loose Lips, LOOSLIPS, and follow Ted's wine column on Epicurious. It's called The Tasting Note. And also Talia's on Twitter. It's at Talia Bioki.
Yeah, just good luck with that.
There's a picture of a unicorn.
Yeah.
Just find the picture of the unicorn. Talia, wow. What's your obsession with unicorns, by the way?
It's really weird. I don't even know. I mean, it's just sort of, they're just these incredible creatures. And I don't know. There's something about them I find like really hilarious. And I guess I just kind of went with it.
All right.
So it's everywhere in my life, the unicorn.
This is something that we're going to try out new. It's going to be a little rapid fire questioning. And then we're going to taste a little wine and talk a little bit more about wines. So let's start off with Ted.
Uh-oh.
And Ted, what I want you to do is quickly, your gut instinct, perfect wine for the following scenarios. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Picnic.
Rosé.
On the beach.
Riesling.
Ooh. Clam bake or lobster bake?
Chenin Blanc from Loire.
Nice. Bowling alley.
Old Vine Zinfandel from Sonoma.
That's actually a good idea. You want to get boozy.
I think it goes with, you know, a lot of bowling alley food, I think. Hot dogs.
All right, Talia.
Okay.
Movie theater.
Beaujolais.
Like that. I often bring wine.
Or
a crew. I assume
sherry
a crew, though.
Popcorn is really good.
Sherry and popcorn.
A crew Beaujolais, I assume.
Yeah, crew Beaujolais. Yes. Yeah, of course.
I once brought
a bottle
to both
of, here.
bottle of champagne, and it just popped so loud in the middle of the movie. That was terrible. Talia, beach.
Muscadet.
Nice.
Tastes like beach.
Yeah. All right, hanging out in Bushwick with your friends.
Ooh. I guess Pet Nat, because you gotta be kind of cool, you know.
What's cool
from
about Pet Nat? Oh, Pet Nat from Loire.
Yeah,
Loire is a theme. Yep.
Yeah,
can't escape it.
Anything from the Loire, like something really obscure, like Pinot d'Anis from the Loire. If you want to hang out in Bushwick, I think it's probably good.
I'd pick Chinon for that one.
That's Chinon. Good. Yeah,
I love that. All right, guys. So Ted was kind enough to bring some sherry for us all to taste. Which is really exciting. We have two of my favorite producers, Lustau and Hidalgo. What'd you bring for us, Ted?
Well, we have, you know, these are great producers. I think Lustau is probably my overall favorite producer. I think their line is great. I think that they don't make a bad wine, pretty much. And I think that there's, as I was saying, you know, before we got on the air, there's sort of 10 producers or so that are imported in the U.S. in any quantity. So we're talking about, you know, you could at a home tasting, you could learn about the 10 producers that have 90% of the U.S. market in pretty quick order. So this is it's a wine region to discover that you could actually get a handle on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you talk about the Loire, we're talking about, I mean, there are thousands of, you know, names to know. But in this area, although it's a complicated process to make it, you could actually get a handle on these.
Yeah, so, I totally agree with that. You know, I think there's great value in these wines as well. And certainly when you open them, they can last for quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really tough to spend more than $30 on a bottle of sherry. And that'll last you a few weeks, too.
So this is interesting, too, because the Almancinista line for Lustau, I think, is one of these, it really kind of got sommeliers interested in sherry, because you had this Almancinista line, you had Hidalgo's Pastrana, you had the La Bota wines. So this comes from smaller producers, and they're like very small lots. You can think of it the same way that you think about champagne. So like these were growers essentially, and Lustau went in and said, okay, well, we're going to bottle this stuff and put it out there. So it's super small production. And then this is obviously Manzanilla Amontillado. So, you can think about sherry on sort of a continuum. So it starts as Manzanilla and then eventually becomes Amontillado. When that actually happens and the distinction is very blurry, it depends on the producer. But basically it's just, you know, I don't know, it becomes, at a certain point, it goes from Manzanilla to Manzanilla Posada to Manzanilla Amontillado. And it's really interesting, I think.
I like the medium browns with sherry. That's what I call everything from there through Palo Cortado, up to PX, up to the sweeties. I like the sweet ones, too, but I really like the ones that are complex with maybe a hint of sweetness, but are essentially this sort of whole middle range, because I think they're the food matches ultimately.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Fino's great with almonds, or it's great as an aperitif, and the PXs of the world are great for, you know, any dessert ice cream. They're great on, in, you know, in Spain, they put it on ice cream, which is amazing. But I think this whole medium area is an awesome food matching zone. What would you pair this one with, Joe?
Well, you know, I think you said one thing that that's really great, and something that I think not everyone realizes is that there's sometimes a hint of sweetness in these wines, but when you have really good sherry, they tend to be very, very dry. I think a lot of people think of sherry as something that that is a sweet, you know, the grandma's sweet sherry, right? But this wine is a dry wine, but because of the caramel, nutty flavors, I think it gives you kind of an impression that it's going to be even sweeter than it is, but it's super dry. You know, sherry's really, really versatile. I think I like this with meats, with grilled meats. It's very savory.
Hen, you know.
Stuffed hen? What do you stuff? What do you stuff a hen with?
Uncle Ben,
tell me.
And pour a bottle of sherry in the middle.
On the grill, you could actually put like a Cornish hen on the grill and like stuff it, and because the smoky flavor is amazing. These nutty tones are incredible.
I think you're completely. I would eat that. Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, Ted, when are you cooking that?
Exactly. If I had a grill, if I had outdoor space, I would.
All right. So what is the what's the second one you brought for us, Ted?
Well, we have Hidalgo, and let me just let's grab this one. We've got a Palo Cortado, and that's another great category, and it's firmly in that sort of medium brown camp.
It's another like blurry category.
Yeah, it's kind of like it almost doesn't really pay to know too much about how they're made, because sometimes there are exceptions and there are these wines that blur. To know Palo Cortado is to love it, though.
True.
What do you guys get out of this one?
I actually had this one last night, among other sherries. Yeah. So this is too close for comfort in a way, but it's really light for a Palo Cortado, and it's kind of got like funk. I mean, you're getting a lot of floor character in the wine.
The yeasty floor thing.
Yeah, totally. And sometimes in Palo Cortado, you're getting more like of an Oloroso character, which is more just kind of those nutty oxidative flavors. And this has more of that kind of like saline, funky, yeasty thing, like you said.
I love it with one of those Spanish soups with almonds in them.
Oh yeah, like a white gazpacho.
Yeah, situation. I think that's that. What about that?
I think that'd be a great pairing. You know, I absolutely love Palo Cortado. That would be the, if I only had to drink one sherry, I would be love the Palo Cortado. But you know, sherry along with Riesling, we were talking about before we started. Those are probably the two darlings of the sommelier community.
Right.
What do you think? Why do you think that there's such popularity amongst industry professionals, and do you think that's translating to the drinking public?
Well, it's complexity for money, I think, ultimately. You know, the Riesling, that, you know, since the 70s, everyone, there's always a movement, will Riesling take off? And it never does. And some of us are thankful, because that means it just never got expensive. Loire is like that, too. Loire is a big sommelier darling, and, you know, we've already mentioned it. We've already shouted out to it a few times. These are the areas that give you an enormous amount of complexity for not that much money, because they haven't been adopted by like crazy collectors who are buying it at auction.
Yeah, hopefully this this radio program doesn't get broadcast to China, because if they find out how good Riesling is with their food, we're all screwed.
Exactly. They all they buy Bordeaux and Burgundy, and you really don't want to drink that with
Let them keep buying Bordeaux
and Chinese food.
That's great. I think that also I mean, sommeliers love the underdog, right? But also, I've been doing a lot of thinking about kind of the slow evolution of the American palate, and how, I mean, you go to the lettuce section at Whole Foods and you're like, oh my God, it's like radicchio, you know, dandelion greens. And now people love Negronis, and our palate for wine is changing as well. And I think we're more open to bitter flavors. We're more open to super savory flavors. And I think you're seeing wines, you know, getting more attention that didn't before because of this change. I think that's like, I think sherry has had a way in because of that.
Yeah. No, I think the bitter thing is, wine writers always have a palate that tends toward the acid and the bitter. And it's just how sweetness.
Some
is,
of them.
Sweetness generally is an entryway into wine. People discover, hey, that's something, it's like a sugar delivery system that's kind of interesting. And then as you know more, you head toward bitter and acidic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what we were drinking even, you know, 20 years ago in America and what people wanted. And I feel bad for Turley wine sometimes because they had this image of these huge wines that were made in the early 90s and mid 90s. Now the style is totally different at Turley, but that's what people wanted. They wanted 17% alcohol with residual sugar. And it's like Frankenstein wine. Yeah. But now everything's kind of coming around, and I think people are more open to, you know, really dry Riesling, which is super mineral, and, you know, savory sherry.
California is coming around too. It's just taken a little while. The wine world is a slow moving ship. So yeah. Turning the direction is essentially going to take 10 years to
get. We hit an iceberg too.
We did. We hit an iceberg. And I think you really hear it in California now. You know, in the old days, I would come and people would tell me, winemakers come and I taste wines with them. And they would say how extracted, rich, big their wines were as a point of pride. Now the word is fresh. No matter what you're making, you come and you say to a wine writer, it's fresh, because freshness connotes acidity. And that's what writers, and I think part of the public, and it's changing toward that, are always looking for. Everyone wants to have a fresh wine.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And as a wine buyer, I always look for acidity because I think it makes me look better at my job. I think if you have a wine that has acidity, the food is going to taste better and you're going to want to keep drinking the wine because your mouth is watering. However, I find that when I talk to guests, I never say the word acidity. And that guests and most people who are drinking wine who aren't wine professionals think of acidity as a terrible, horrible, bad thing.
And hence, fresh is our now euphemism for acidity, basically, I think, is what in wine notes you see companies writing. Yeah. And that's what they mean.
Mm-hmm. Fresh, or I say crisp a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't always work for
acid
a red wine.
It sounds like a lemon puckering. You're not going to, you know, look at like the experience, but...
All right, Ted, so what is this last sherry that you brought for us?
We're back to Lustau, because I think they're so great. This is their Deluxe Cream, and my next column at Epicurious, which is coming out, I think, October 1st, is going to be about matching sherry to dessert. And it's not all going to be sweet sherry. It's going to be some of these medium browns, as I call them, are going to be in the mix, too. But I think you got to have a sweetie every now and then, too. Yeah. What do you guys think about this?
It's funny because cream sherry really gets sort of like, you know, a bad rap, and just the blended sherries in general. So, I mean, cream sherry is essentially PX mixed with Oloroso. And obviously there's Harvey's Bristol Cream, which is maybe like the sort of white Zin of the sherry world. And but cream sherry can be absolutely delicious.
This is really light and delicate. You don't really think about it. This is sort of... If this were a Riesling in terms of sweetness, you wouldn't think this is a crazy sweet Riesling. It's not... heavy, that's for sure. I like this has a lot of delicacy, and it's really fruity.
I think that the a high quality cream sherry is in a way like a sweet champagne. It's something that there aren't too many of them left, but if you find, I know like Billicard Salmon is still making the demi-sec champagne. But there's certainly really great applications, even though it's something that with, you know, informed wine drinkers might be going out of style a little bit more. But I think that is delicious, and I totally agree with you. And you want
and
something...
Cheap.
And it's cheap.
These are all cheap. I mean, you cannot find a sherry more than $30 as far as I know in terms of suggested retail.
The one that can be over that I absolutely love is this line called La Bota from Bodegos...
Equipo Navassos,
Equipo Navassos, yes. And they're absolutely fantastic. When we opened, you know, we opened up Lertuzzi, I bought all of this, you know, La Bota cherry because I love it and I tried to drink it and no one would drink it. Maybe it's just the fact that we're in an Italian restaurant. I ended up giving Talia a bottle for her birthday.
That's true. I still have it. And they're tough to find now. I mean, this is sort of like major, sort of the top of the geek line in
that's
the sherry
pretty,
world. Yeah, so it's they're
hard. You can find it, get it for sure.
Yeah, exactly. But also an interesting thing too about sherry in terms of making its way to the wine world. I think the cocktail world was really a gateway for sherry. And I think that you had, you know, back in 2007 or even a little bit before that, you had bartenders kind of, you know, sherry was sort of a revival for them because, you know, back in the 19th century, sherry was a big part of the barman's repertoire. And I think that sort of made its resurgence. And then you had slowly but surely sommeliers starting to pay attention to sherry through like mixologists, quote unquote.
It's a great cocktail ingredient among other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you're doing any sherry cocktails right now, but it's, you know, it's a great sort of like, you know, it's a great replacement for vermouth for a lot of different things.
Yeah, and I find that it's a little bit more stable than vermouth. I think vermouth can be, you really need to be careful with it. You need to refrigerate it. You need to. It doesn't have the kind of shelf life of sherry. And I mean, especially with the lighter style of sherry, you do also need to be careful. They don't have the best shelf life, but it's something that doesn't cost a lot. And I'm a big sherry fan as well.
And also, guess what? You can open it and then you do put the cork back in, and it's going to hang out for quite a long time. Yeah. So this is if you're thinking about value, you're never tossing it because it's over the hill.
Yeah. If you're a Manhattan drinker, I mean, vermouth is sort of the plight of the Manhattan drinker, because you know, there's most of the time, I'd say maybe like 6 times out of 10, you're going to have vermouth that's past its prime in your drink. So that's right. Kind of a bummer.
You know, we had Alan Katz on the show last week, and he said that I asked him when you go to a bar, like what's your one indicator if, you know, this is a bar that knows what they're doing or is not? And he pointed out, I always look at their vermouths. If they have a good selection of vermouths and they're paying attention to it, that lets me know that they're going to be, that's probably someone who's paying a little bit more attention. I'm going to pose the same kind of question for both of you for a wine list. When you open up a wine list, how do you know if these guys are doing something good, if they know what they're doing, or if they're just kind of phoning it in?
Well, I'm a fan of Cabernet Franc. That's kind of my favorite grape. That's my desert island grape. It's kind of a quirky, high acid, a little bit finicky and strange red grape. And I think that when I find Chenin or some other Cabernet Franc, I think that's it tends to be the best value on a wine list. And since I'm always looking for that, that's a great indicator. Something from Chenin, something from Cab Franc elsewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know, it's hard because there's a lot of, I think that the level of wine lists today is so much higher because we've got really great importers. There's so much available in the market. So I think it's a lot easier to put together a good wine list. I think that really it comes down to your definition of a good wine list. And I think it comes down to how, you know, it fits with the restaurant. And you have some people, I think, that are putting together stuff that's obscure for the sake of obscurity and doesn't necessarily fit with sort of the culture of the restaurant. So you kind of have to, so this isn't really an answer, but I guess it's sort of thinking about the wine list in context. And whether it's just the sommelier kind of just doing whatever the sommelier wants to do, or really thinking about the food, really thinking about the place. I mean, Cabernet Franc is a great thing. Beaujolais, obviously, because, you know, it's stuff that you're seeing the sommelier kind of, you know, having an eye for value. And those are two great examples of that.
Another thing is that I don't want, no matter how good the wines are, I don't want to see a wine list that's 25 pages, because guess what? I'm not there to read a book about how many things you have in your cellar. I would rather have 25 amazing wines that were actually hand-picked and that you want to hand-sell me through a conversation. I don't want to read through everything you have in your cellar. I mean, who even has time for that, even if you know about wine in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I mean, I always, when I'm putting together wine lists, I always think about quite a few things. Number one, does it complement the food? Because the food, at the end of the day, is really the star. And the wine, for me, is just the sauce that the chef doesn't really ever get to taste. So does it complement the food? Is there a range of styles that everyone who's looking for the style that they want can find it? And does it represent a good value? Those are all important things. But then also some of the things that you brought up before, does it have a personality? Is it saying something? And then there's functional stuff that a beverage director looks at. Yeah. You know, like, is it going to make us a little bit of money? Does it work with our physical space and that kind of things? But really, you know, as a diner, is it good for the food? Are there enough options? And does it say something? And so, you know, we always try to find something that has a wine list, that a wine list that has something to say.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it can be done short and sweet. Usually a good team can put together a pithy, short and sweet wine list, I think.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What are your favorite wine lists right now?
Oh, well, I love drinking at Vinegar Hill House. Mm-hmm. I think they have a really cool list. Mm-hmm. Diner, because I love the fact that they'll get behind something and kind of just explore it. Like I think you were mentioning Cabernet Franc before. They really love Cabernet Franc there.
I got to go back there. It's a great restaurant.
Gramercy Tavern, oh my god, they have such good values, and they just, you know, it's a wine list that they'll have something for everyone, and it'll be really good. Like, you could bring your Aunt Sue from like the middle of the country and she'll find something that she wants,
and they could be phoning it in. Those guys have the reputation, but they're not phoning it in, and kudos to them for that.
Oh my god, everything there is good. I know there's a lot, and oh my god, Casamono. Mm-hmm. Dying to get Ashley on the show. It's the best Spanish wine list I've ever seen in Spain or New York or anywhere in the world. I don't know. There's a lot.
Yeah. Spain is really sort of underrepresented, in especially in New York, you know?
Yeah. But even then, that's despite the tapas craze, which is, I mean, I live in Chelsea and there's a tapas, a really good tapas restaurant on every single block near my house. It's a little weird, but I think we haven't quite seen the right importing combination of getting the wines here in the first place, mm-hmm. for these places to get them on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and that's really important. And it's something that Talia brought up, like the importer and distributor really are very, very important in what you're ultimately drinking. I've been to a few places, like Croatia, for instance, where there's some really exciting and interesting wines, but they're not very well represented by importers who know what they're doing. So when you have someone like a Joe Dresner or Kermit Lynch or Rosenthal, who bring in not only great wines and have something to say about it, but have a staff of people who can really speak about them intelligently, I think that really helps to promote the region. So yeah, I'm excited to see. I think there's a lot of great things going on in Spain, and so that's mm-hmm. a really good point.
Yeah. No, Spain is really exciting right now, and obviously, I mean, for most people, all they know still is Priorat and Ribera del Duero, and nothing beyond that. Maybe Albarino, but, you know, Galicia is this whole new world right now, and obviously Jerez, Sanlúcar, Montemorelos.
All right. Thank you guys both.
Thank you.
No, it's really fun.
Thanks so much to Talia Baiocchi. Again, follow her at Talia Baiocchi. Figure out how to spell that on Twitter at Talia Baiocchi, and Ted Luce, a little bit easier, at Luce Lips. That's on Twitter. And please definitely do read their columns on Eater and Epicurious and every other publication.
drink sherry in the morning. It turns out to be great.
And hope you guys tune in again to heritageradionetwork.org. This is Joe Campanelli for In the Drink.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.